You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Today on the Radio Cafe, we're going to be talking about one of the hot subjects in New Mexico today, and that is the education of our children. Stay tuned, we'll be doing that in just a moment. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential. Offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. We've been doing a number of shows lately on government in New Mexico, and especially during the legislative session when a lot of legislators and citizens are focused on what to do about various problems in the state, including, and with a big focus on, education. In today's show, we'll be talking to Jal Mehta. He's a professor at Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of several books on education in America. He's a scholar of educational reform and knows a lot about what we've gotten wrong as well as right. So I thought maybe it would be not only interesting, but perhaps even helpful to listen to this while we are making decisions about education. I had the chance to sit down with Professor Mehta when he visited New Mexico last month. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So there has been so much conversation in New Mexico and around the country, not only for the last few years, but for well over a century, about reforming our educational system, making it better for all the kids in the country. And it seems like if we're going to be educational reformers, and if we're going to talk about education, we should kind of agree on what the purpose of education is in the first place. Is there a consensus on that?
There does not seem to be consensus. And I think that's part of why it has been so difficult to reform or improve schools. As you know, we're a system with 50 states and more than 13,000 school districts, and each of those districts and states gets to offer its own view of what it means to be an educated person. And there are some advantages to that. Like, that's how we built the school system in the first place, right? You've got small towns coming together and making agreements to pay taxes so that some people would educate their kids. So that was sort of the genius of decentralization. And then the challenge has been all the kind of inequality that's emerged across lots of different places within it. But to answer your question, I don't think there is a consensus on it. I think it's clear that the world is becoming more complex and that you could graduate from high school in 1960 and get a job at a factory and support a middle-class existence. And that's much more difficult to do these days. So it's clear that, you know, education, the sort of cognitive demands have gone up. But if you really sort of got down to it, like, should we emphasize more creativity, collaboration, curiosity, community, social emotional support, being an educated sort of like a reflective thinker, liberal arts, more applied? I think reasonable people might disagree on some of those things.
Have the many kind of strains of educational reform that have happened in recent years, I mean, they're very disparate movements. Do they have anything in common?
Dissatisfaction with the system as it is.
Yeah.
The nature of that dissatisfaction varies greatly, right? Like, it ranges from people who homeschool or the movement in the 80s and 90s of the Christian right to kind of put more people on school boards to make schools more responsive to their concerns, to people pushing charter schools, test scores, equity. There's a lot of different demands. I mean, I think part of it is that the public school is an institution. It's kind of a hybrid institution that is trying to serve a lot of ends simultaneously. You know, it needs to house students during the day. It needs to teach them some academics. It needs to exercise their bodies some, et cetera, et cetera. And so because it encompasses all these purposes, it doesn't necessarily do any of those purposes that well. And then people come along and they're like, well, we would like it to be really good at X. And they look at it and they're like, well, it's not as good as we would like it to be in X. And so then that leads to criticism and then reform. But like what the direction is of that critique varies a lot based on who's doing the talking.
Well, you just said a bunch of things before, like becoming a critical thinker and a creative thinker and a citizen and things like that. And I remember when I was in high school and even in college, there was always this kind of like undercurrent of people who would say, well, what good is being an English major? What kind of a job is that going to get you? So there was this like strain that says the only purpose of education is to get you ready for the workforce. How do those kinds of conversations happen in actual education circles? What do they look like?
Those conversations are still alive and well today. I think that the kind of skills one would need to write a good essay or decipher a piece of literature or connect or compare across periods, like those are not that different from the skills that lots of different sort of modern workplaces require, some version of writing, communication, connecting, comparing, etc. So I think what people are tempted to do is that they want to sort of merge the desire for a liberal arts education and argue that if we really gave you a good liberal arts education, that would actually prepare you for a lot of different jobs out there. And so the conflict isn't as great as you might think.
One of the things that is being talked about is that the teaching profession is not really as highly regarded in the U.S. as it is in other countries, to the point where it's not even fully a profession the way law or medicine are professions. And you've written a great deal about this. What's going on? Is it a gender thing? Is it because teaching has always been quote-unquote women's work where it's not like that everywhere? Or what is it?
That's a complicated question. I think gender is definitely part of it. Pay is clearly part of it. And those two things are related, right? If you view teaching as something that anyone can do, and if it's viewed as sort of women's work, if it's connected to child rearing, it somehow gets devalued in its complexity and the need to really pay a significant wage for it. So the confluence of a lot of those factors have come together. You know, there are some other countries, Finland's the most famous one, that like made a decision to become much more selective in who could become a teacher. And they did that by just closing a number of their normal schools and centralizing it in 8 institutions. So sometimes there are situations where sort of policy choices made it more selective. And then as it became more selective, it became more popular. And there was sort of that kind of a cycle.
And also better paid.
Also in Scandinavia, there are much higher taxes on high earners. So you're forgoing a lot less in terms of real post-tax income by not moving into a more lucrative field.
So if you go into teaching, you might make a good living. And if you go into high finance, you might make a better living, but you're not going to become a super gazillionaire because that higher end is taxed.
Yep, that's right. You pay a lot of it back in taxes. And in return, you'd get things like subsidized free childcare and other things that the state provides there that isn't provided here.
One of the things that I think you've also written about is the fact that Americans tend not to really, I mean, in general, like to pay for public services. Does that speak to how we regard the teaching profession?
I mean, I think I was talking with my colleague, David Cohen, who's very wise, professor at Michigan, and I was making an argument about education needing to become more of a profession like law and medicine. And he said, Jal, you know, you have to realize that law and medicine are largely private professions. And so like what supports them is people pay a lot of private dollars for their services. And so with that comes money, and with money comes status and prestige. Whereas in education, all of the incentives are the opposite, right? Like every dollar spent on education or teacher salaries is a dollar that's not spent on some other public service, or it's a dollar that someone's paying in taxes that they wouldn't otherwise have been paying in taxes. So all the incentives are against essentially like boosting pay. And so pay is connected to status and respect. I do think that the solution is that we should differentiate pay in teaching, that lots of countries have career ladders, including master teachers. And so like, imagine a world where like, let's say like 10% of teachers made $150,000 a year, say, And that 10% worked summers, they helped develop curricular materials, they did some of the training of new teachers, and that you had a lot of other teachers who, you know, they taught, they wanted to be good at their jobs, but they also wanted to be home after school to hang out with their kids. They liked having summers off to go on vacations with their families. Like, you know, what if teaching were a more differentiated profession? But what if there were sort of an option for a small group of like really ambitious people who wanted to not only teach, but study teaching, write about teaching, make materials, train new teachers? Like, why not have roles for those people, which exists in Singapore, Shanghai, other places? It's not like that far-flung a notion.
How does that differ from professionalizing the whole entire teaching profession?
I mean, basically, the way that the teaching profession evolved in the United States was we assumed that teaching was relatively simple work that could be done by women before they got married or had children. And we invested a lot of money in administrators, superintendents. So those were the sort of higher status actors, and their work was the complex work of managing these organizations. And teachers were sort of like the widgets who were being managed by these managers. And I feel like fundamentally, like, that was just sort of a category mistake, that like teaching is a complex work. And so with complex work, what you do is you spend a lot of money and time in the training portion. It's longer, it's more residency-based, it's more learning from really good previous practitioners, et cetera, et cetera. And when you do those things, then you don't need as much sort of bureaucratic oversight because you've put your trust sort of fundamentally in the profession. So like at some basic level, we made a kind of category mistake. Now, I imagine there might be some teachers listening out there and they might be thinking like, yeah, but I'm a great teacher. Like, this is very unfair. And I would say, yeah, you probably are. But I would think of it more like the way we do it now is it's unfair to teachers. The system of training is so patchwork, and the inconsistency between what teachers get trained in and what they get asked to do in schools is very high. And then as a result, what happens is that teachers just do a lot of learning on the job, and they learn from their colleagues and their friends, and they go to a good professional development, or they read a website, or they engage in some study. And so some of those teachers, through all of that work, end up being fantastic teachers. But it's not really fair to sort of like put it on individuals to excel in these ways. Like, it's something that like we should support as a system and society.
Are there other examples in public service that you think are working well that would provide a comparable model? I mean, I think about the judiciary. I mean, judges are publicly paid employees. They make good money. They're very well trained, and with some notable exceptions, very well respected.
Yeah, I think nurses are a good example. I guess the other point I would make is that, like, if you had interviewed me 5 years ago, I would have said a lot of the same things I'm saying right now about teaching as a profession. But having spent a lot of time in schools over the last 5 or 6 years, I think the sort of the boxes of the school itself, like the structures in which teachers are operating at schools, are sort of inhibiting them from doing their best work. So I think there's like one agenda around professionalizing teaching, and then I think there's a whole other agenda around changing some of the core structures of schooling.
Say more about that. Like, what are you seeing in the classroom? What's not going so well?
Like, I'll give an example. So like, there was a guy in our study. So we spent 6 years studying 30 high schools across the US, and we spent a lot of time observing classrooms. And one thing that really came out was the difference between classroom spaces and extracurricular spaces. So like in classrooms, there were 45-minute blocks. Teachers had to process like 150 students a week. So like, really think about that, like 150 students a week. Like, you're an English teacher. If you give homework and students do some writing and you want to assess that, you know, like, how many weekends is it just to like read those 150 essays? You might be a great teacher, but you might also be a mother, a sister, an aunt, a coach. Like, you know, when are you going to do that? So those structures are not supportive. And then in comparison, in the after school space, students were treated as producers, as people who could make things, and teachers were more in the sort of coaching, facilitating, helping them make it role, which seemed to be much more enjoyable for both students and teachers. Students were much clearer on the purpose of their learning. There was a product, a newspaper, a theater performance, a game, like something that this was culminating towards. Everybody could sort of see the purpose of it. So anyway, so there was a guy in my study who was a Spanish teacher during the day, and he was a theater director in the afternoon. And he said, you know, in Spanish, like, I see 150 kids a week. We're mostly not speaking in their native language. A third of the kids want to be there. A third of the kids, like, are just there because they're trying to get to college. And a third of the kids are looking at me like I'm putting them in a dungeon. And then in the theater rehearsal, like, there's 30 people, 11 actors. We've got 3 hours a day. Everybody's chosen to be there. We're working towards a product. Like, we know each other. We know each other's names. We know each other's histories. We go deep. There's a lot of reflection. There's a lot of hard learning. It's not always easy. People are being vulnerable. Then they're producing something, etc. And so, you know, part of me just wonders, like, well, how come all the good stuff happens around the edges and we just sort of, like, endure the main part of school? What if we relaxed some of the things that happened during the day to look like more like some of the things that happened after the bell? I think if we did that, we would make it easier for teachers to succeed.
Are you seeing classrooms where that's happening?
I mean, you could see it in project-based classrooms. We saw a lot of good project-based classrooms in our study where there was a product, for example, like writing a field guide to the San Diego Bay was one example. And so the students went out and they researched the bay, and then they wrote a book which was sold in local bookshops as like a field guide to the bay. And like, could the students have written like an authoritative textbook on something? No. But like, could they do a field guide to the bay? Yes, they could. It was within what they could do, and they got much more invested in what they were learning. So we did see examples of teachers doing it in project-based ways. You know, we did see some examples of just really good English discussions or really careful investigations of history using documents. And like, there were examples sort of like within the box of good teaching. I wouldn't want to say otherwise, but the teachers, like if you take history as an example, the teachers, especially the good teachers, you know, they'd written history theses in college. So like, they had some idea of like how you construct history. But when they were asked to sort of go from Mesopotamia to the French Revolution over the course of the year, you know, that's like a dynasty a week. You know, Socrates himself couldn't bring that alive. Like, it's just impossible. You know, so like one teacher said, like, the Crusades get a week and the Cold War gets 2 days. And so that was like cram learning. But then we saw like, you know, an elective on the Cold War. And so then they had a semester to work on the Cold War, and they watched film, and they read books, and they looked at the history, and they wrote essays, and they interviewed their parents about, like, what it had been like to, you know, hide under your desk, and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, like, they really understood something about the Cold War. So I think we need to sort of slow down, and the system does not really permit that.
One of the things that I was thinking about when you were talking just now was that if you are in a theater group, or if you are on a sports team, or if you're on the debate team, or whatever it is, you're all working toward the same goal. Whereas in class, you're all on some level competing with each other because you've got to take a test and everybody gets graded, and some people are going to get an A and a B and a C, and some are going to fail. And so it's really structurally different. How do you deal with that? That's kind of seems like it's kind of built in.
So first, what you said, we noticed as well. It was very noticeable in the study. So like in the theater example, people had roles of different prominence, from a senior who was a lead in the show and was like on the stage in almost every scene, to the assistant's props manager, who was a freshman who had just joined the high school, who basically just like had to make sure that like the right props were on the right table at the right moment. But the whole show falls apart if the right prop isn't on the right table at the right moment. So like, even though the like level of responsibility that those two had was wildly different, they were in a certain sense interdependent. Like, the whole thing wouldn't work without everybody doing their role. And I think that that was really critical because it fostered this team community feeling. And, you know, you can hear that on sports teams where people have different roles and you're going to be the scorer, but you've helped us with the defense or whatever it is. Could you do that in classes? I mean, I think in project-based environments where they're not being graded on a curve and students are supportive of each other, in the class that I teach at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, all the students are working on projects in groups of three or four. And at the end, they get examined by panels. So this might be like superintendents or people, teachers or principals or people out there in the work world who know about whatever they're doing. And so it's not competitive, but there's sort of like a team sense that like, okay, like today we're in-house, it's just us and we're practicing these presentations, but we better give each other good critique because next week we're going to like face a real audience and like they're going to ask us hard questions. So better for us internally to ask each other hard questions first. So, and I stole that structure from a good high school that I saw. So I think there are ways to sort of change the roles within classes, and I think good teachers do that.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation invests in the dreams and futures of Northern New Mexico students through scholarships. Support is available for 4-year and 2-year degrees, as well as trade certifications. January 22, 2019 is the deadline to apply for 4-year scholarships available to high school seniors and current undergraduates who are residents of the 7 counties of Northern New Mexico and meet additional criteria. Citizenship is not required. For more information and application details, visit lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. And now back to our program. You are here visiting New Mexico and talking to teachers and educators and policymakers and all kinds of people. When you're in a state which is often ranked 49th or 50th in education, what kinds of policies can New Mexico begin to adopt, or can a state like New Mexico begin to adopt to make change? I mean, where does the change come from? Does it have to be on multiple fronts at the same time? What are these conversations like that you're having with educators and policymakers?
I mean, I think the answer to that is both, right? Like that the best answer would be comprehensive and systemic, but the worst answer would be thinking that unless we can be comprehensive and systemic, we can't do anything, so we shouldn't start. Like, you know, it's like that old adage about like, when's the best time to plant a tree? So, you know, if you wanted to take a systemic approach, I don't know the state that well, but just looking at some of the numbers, you know, you have a lot of students in child poverty, and so addressing that early childhood, preschool, like can students sort of start school in the right frame of mind? A lot of states, Georgia, Oklahoma, et cetera, have had a lot of luck with that. And the returns to investment on early childhood education are very high. Like if you total up what people pay in taxes because they get better jobs, and then you subtract what it would cost if people go to prison or otherwise. So there's a lot of research that supports that as a good investment. I mean, in the long run, the state has been, the people I'm meeting with have been reading this report called No Time to Lose, which is basically like a synthesis of what the leading countries around the world do in education, and it tries to sort of apply it at a state level. And it would suggest taking, it does suggest a systemic approach. It does suggest, you know, you want to work on equalizing funding, you want to set standards for new teachers, you want to set standards for students, you want to support teacher learning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So like there is, if you want, like if the state wanted to take a kind of holistic agenda, there is a blueprint out there. If there isn't appetite for taking a holistic agenda, then I would suggest picking some issue and investing in it enough to make progress, and then using the progress you've made on that to sort of build more public confidence and do more work. I mean, one example I studied was in Ontario, Canada, and there they just did some work around high school graduation rates. So rather than having a sort of office of high school graduation in like the Ontario ministry, they used the money that they would have used for that to essentially appoint like one coordinator at each school, which was like half of a salary slot. So it's like someone who was already in the school, but they paid off half of their time to work on this. And basically their job was just to look at how students were doing in ninth grade, look at the students who were really off track in ninth grade in terms of truancy, not coming to school, behind in their classes, etc. And then they pooled all the information across the teachers about what they knew about those kids. And then they built a support structure for those kids who were struggling. And that really helped. Like people paid attention to them earlier and they did better. And then like the graduation rates went up. And then the Ontario government went back to the Ontario people and said, look, we started this 3 years ago. At that time, graduation rates were 67%. Now they're 72%. If you gave us 3 more years, we could be at 77%. So they sort of used this kind of back and forth between a really pragmatic strategy at the school level and like making some progress on the indicator to sort of build more public buy-in. So if there's not appetite for like doing the whole shebang, I would suggest like picking pieces like that.
You've talked about building on the strengths of schools and students and school districts. So there might be a poor district in New Mexico, rural districts that don't have a lot of resources. How do you build, like, how do you identify the strengths in a region and then build on those to make a really good school system?
I would urge every school out there to sort of think about, like, just do this as a thought experiment. If you were going to be the best school in America, situated exactly where you are, what would that look like? Like, what would be the best version of yourself? And if you were sitting in New York City, the answer to that might look like lots of partnerships with, like, you know, the Met and all the other cultural institutions in New York, and your students could sort of travel back and forth and they could curate museum exhibits and become sort of world known experts on that sort of stuff, et cetera. But like, you're not going to do that from like rural New Mexico. And we're sitting in Santa Fe here. We have strong traditions in art, in Native American culture, et cetera. So like, how might we define what it is that we have around us and what kind of learning opportunities does that provoke? And then like, what sort of things could we make? Like, could we make documentaries? Could we make books? Could we do productions? Could we write scientific papers? Like, there are essentially sort of resources in every corner of America. They just look a little different. And so if schools took advantage of that, it would really enliven, and schools do this, but like if they did more of it, it would really enliven the education and allow students to produce really meaningful things.
One of the conversations that happens is the argument between those who believe in kind of rote learning and more experiential and project-based learning. Is that an either or? One of my nicknames is Conan the Grammarian. I mean, I really believe in grammar and punctuation and being able to write proper sentences and speak properly, and that should be learned in school. And there are kids who are teenagers now who've never even practically heard the word grammar, much less know what an indirect object is. So does it have to be, like, can they learn that stuff and also be engaged learners working on projects that are interesting?
Sure. There are a lot of dichotomies in education that are false. One is like, people talk about like skills and content versus facts. They're like, oh, this 21st century learning, it's all about skills and contents in the absence of facts. That's silly. Like, no one can say anything of any complexity without drawing on a lot of facts. In our conversation, we've both drawn on a fair number of facts as we develop interpretations, but the facts aren't worth much without being able to put them together and develop interpretations. So clearly false, facts versus concepts and skills. And then rote learning versus projects, I mean, they can be very different, but I feel like most significant arenas of learning have elements of both. So all the literature on expertise suggests there has to be some deliberate practice, and that practice isn't always necessarily fun, but that it's part of sort of building the sort of larger corpus. But
like playing scales if you're a musician.
Like playing scales if you're a musician, or practicing layups if you want to be a basketball player, or whatever it is. But those things are motivated by playing a piece, by playing a game, etc. So you're sort of like embedding the broccoli eating parts within the larger arc of the thing that makes you want to do it in the first place. And so like, you can do the same thing. Like, if you're doing a project where you're writing a letter to the city council to advocate for X or Y, okay, that's something that kids might want to do. But like, how are you going to write a letter? Like, what does a salutation look like? That will give people a lot of incentive to sort of want to learn the grammatical things that you're trying to teach them. And you don't have to teach them all one by one, right? So you could be like, let's say the kids are doing this city council project and they're all writing letters. You don't have to like go through every letter and say like, this is how you want, like, you can't end a sentence with a preposition. Like, you don't have to do that for each kids. You could read through a bunch of the papers, discover that that's a common problem, and then you could mini lesson. You could be like, look, you guys are working on your letters. I just want you to know a lot of you are struggling with this, and like, here's why this doesn't work. So that kind of back and forth, I think, is key, and good teachers already do that. We just don't do enough of it.
One of the continuing themes in American life has been historically, and is very much alive now is kind of anti-intellectualism and anti-elitism. How does that play out in the conversations that are going on about education, which is about developing intellectual strength and rigor, among other things?
That's a good question. I think there are sort of two answers to that question, so I'll just sort of give you both sides. On the one hand, at the end of the book that I just finished, I said that the values that have been evoked by the current president, distrust of expertise, disregard for facts, unwillingness to believe in science, just being untethered from any rules of logic and rationality, and also the xenophobia, the othering people who are not like you and key dimensions. All of those things I think of are sort of antithetical to the kind of education that I'm talking about. So in one sense, like, I don't think you can sort of pull any punches. That's not a slight against Republicans or against conservatives. There's plenty of people who are Republicans and conservatives who believe in science and evidence, who think rigorously, who think critically, creatively, etc.
Well, and a generation ago, they were the elitists.
Right, right. Yep, that's true as well. So in that sense, like, I do think there's a sort of certain strain in our politics that is really antithetical to a lot of things I'm talking about. On the other hand, I have a colleague, Ron Berger, who works for an organization called Expeditionary Learning, which promotes student-led learning across the country. And Ron spends a lot of time in red states. And Ron frequently starts his presentations by saying, look, like, I'm from Massachusetts. We probably disagree on a bunch of big picture political stuff. But here's what I want for my kids. I want them to be thoughtful, kind, respectful, caring human beings. Like, those are honest. Like, those are my values. And the kind of curriculum that we're going to try to do with your kids will promote those values. So, like, we might disagree on all of this, like, 10,000 foot stuff, but, like, if we come down to the kid level, there's actually a lot more agreement than you would think. And I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. I certainly have met a lot of people with whom I disagree politically, whose visions of what they want for their kids are not that different from the things that I would want for my kids. So I'm trying to sort of answer your questions both ways. So, like, on the one hand, yes, I think a big strain of our politics right now is really antithetical to this. On the other hand, people's sort of core values and their hopes for kids might be less different than our national political dialogue would lead you to believe.
What are some of the ways in which educational programs that you've seen, ways of teaching in the classroom, ways of treating kids, help with the really difficult issues of racial discrimination, for example, and class discrimination that we're facing as a country?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, on the one hand, every generation is sort of more facile with lines of difference than the ones before it. Like, it was more natural for me to have friends across, say, racial groups. Like, I just didn't think about it as much and than it was for my parents' generation, you know, so there's some of that. In a lot of the best situations I've seen, especially in high schools, adults have let the kids lead some of the learning. So, like, for example, there was at one school that I studied, some kids drove a Confederate flag around the driveway and sort of shouted out some racist slogans of the school. And the principal was new, he was black, and this got, like, written up in the city newspaper within a day, and, like, really not what you're looking for as a new principal. Some students were really unhappy about it, and they sort of led an assembly explaining how it had made them feel. And there's no shortage at this point of, like, workshops or exercises or narratives, or there's all kinds of sort of structures out there that people can use now to sort of try to understand each other better. And so if adults involve kids in constructive ways in these conversations, good things can happen. In my own experience in higher ed, there is really no substitute for really genuine listening. We've had a lot of luck with having students who are racially different really describe
take like 5 minutes to describe aspects of their background and how that shaped the way they see certain questions, and then with the other students just listening, and then vice versa, and then presenting the other student's narrative to the class and things like that. Those seem to be some of the most powerful things that we've done, because it sort of forces you to really get into other people's shoes.
One of the things that you and many other educators are looking at is just simply the concept of engagement. Like if a kid is in school and is not really that interested, but they're there because they have to be and so on, it's such a huge contrast between like the kind of scenario you just described with kids really listening to each other's personal stories, or being in the theater group or on the sports team or whatever. So getting kids genuinely engaged in the classroom, I mean, does that go back to the kind of project and, you know, experiential learning that you've been talking about? Or what are some of the keys to really getting kids engaged?
So there's project-based learning. There's what educators call problem-based learning, where you're not going out into the world, but you're sort of starting with a sort of a puzzle or a conundrum. In math, sometimes problem-based learning works better than project-based learning, because all the time you spend getting out in the world like dilutes some of the math that you're actually trying to get across. But math is full of puzzles and anomalies, and like, why would this be true under those circumstances? And good teachers sort of lead with those sorts of things. I think choice is really big. So if you can't have choice across, maybe you can have choice within. So like, can students in high school English, can they make some choices about which books they read? Could we have more electives? Like, if the goal of like ninth grade English is to teach kids to analyze themes and symbols and draw inferences, there are lots of different books that could allow you to do that. So like, would it be possible to have a curriculum where sort of more elective based, and so students are choosing to read more of the things they want to read, but the sort of core skills are in common? You know, in my class, if I'm teaching about what deep or more powerful learning looks like, the first year I did it, I was like, oh, let's look at this history lesson and let's think about how we could deepen this lesson. Then the second year, after I figured out something about choice, I was like, okay, we're going to have like a history lesson, a science lesson, a math lesson, and an English lesson. You guys can pick which one you want to work on, and you can go off into the group of the one you want to work on, and like, you try to deepen the lesson, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about what each of you learned. And so like, all of a sudden, from my perspective, it's like the same lesson. They're like learning the same things, we're pulling out the same points. But from their perspective, it's like so much better, because I like came to school as a history teacher, and he's not making me sit there like go through this math task. So yeah, hooks and choice. But I think the more serious question we might have to grapple with is, as kids get older, like, how much choice should we give them? In high school, should you be able to have like a major and a minor? Would that be a bad thing? Like in performing arts schools, where kids spend half the day doing their performing arts and half the day doing their academics, like, is that too much choice? And I guess I would come down on like, you know, schools should expose kids to lots of things, because if you don't expose them, they're never going to know what they would like. And you need to expose them to enough of something so that they get some sense. Sometimes something that looks really difficult at the beginning, once you get a little bit better at it, you get interested in it. So I think exposure is an important goal of school. I think there's some canonical knowledge that's important for people to know something about, like climate change, for example. But reality, like, people forget a lot of the more specific things that they learned. And so I think the trade-offs of giving them more choice overall would be worth it, because it would be so much more meaningful to them, and thus a lot more of it would carry forward.
When you talk about deepening learning, give us an example of what might be a superficial lesson and then how you deepen that in the classroom.
Let's say it's like biology and parts of the cell. Most superficial, here's the cell, here are the parts, copy them over from one sheet to another. Then teachers might try something like, okay, let's make it more fun. Like, let's have everybody be like a part of the cell, and you could dance out parts of the cell. That's potentially better because it's like more fun, but it doesn't necessarily deepen it, because the knowledge you have might be exactly the same as the knowledge you had before. A good task might be like, imagine that like a cell were a city. Tell us what the functions are of the different parts of the cell, and thus, if they were in a city, like what roles those would play in the city.
And so is this part like the center or the engine that makes the city go or whatever? And so that last task, if you can answer that last task, you can transfer, which means that you not only understand what the parts of the cell are, you understand why they're there and how they work together. And so the ability to understand those underlying conceptual structures and then the ability to transfer them, which is a big thing in education research. Like, can you transfer things from one domain to another? Like, once you can do that, that shows that you actually really have it.
So would you consider like deepening involves making analogies between what you know and something that's a little different?
Making analogies is one good way of showing that you have underlying conceptual understanding, not simply the sort of surface level symptoms. Like, have you ever listened to Car Talk?
Yeah.
So like Car Talk, right? The person who calls in, they know the symptoms. Like my car, when it's cold, it doesn't, you know, go as fast on the highway. So like there, you're seeing the person with the surface level knowledge. Like they can see the symptoms. And then the person on the other end is like, well, does it happen more in summer or winter when it rains, when it snows? So like, what are those questions? Those are essentially like probes based on like an underlying analysis of the system. And so like knowing how the system works, that's leading to those questions. And so those questions are indicative of the deeper knowledge. They found in studies of expertise with physicians too, that beginning physicians, that their sort of incoming physicals are much longer than more experienced physicians. And that's because beginners, and this is probably the best thing for them to do, they just like checklist. They just like go through everything. And more experienced physicians essentially like have a series of like hypotheses in their mind. So you like, you come in and you say, I have X. They don't ask you like, you know, were you pregnant when you were 15? Because like nothing you could say to that would be relevant to the symptom. But there's like six things it could be. And they'll ask you questions depending that will try to help them narrow it down. And so again, like it's the difference between sort of like the recipe kind of knowledge, which is the checklist, and the conceptual knowledge, which is like, okay, here's how the parts work. And so that's why I want to know about this versus that.
What are your hopes for American education as a whole? I mean, there's so many schools that we hear about, you know, here and there. There's a school where a principal took great leadership and the school is doing amazing things, or a school district really decided to improve and they did so. But those are still sort of, it's sort of like the, you know, farmers markets. Like there's a few farmers markets here and there. People are eating really healthy food, but most of the fare in the supermarkets is still not very healthy or very fresh and so on. Do you have like a vision for making the whole of American education significantly stronger and more deepening for the students and the teachers, and then by extension, the community?
Yes. I think we built a system in a different era to do different things. So at the time, at the beginning of the 20th century, most kids were not going to college. The average kid was getting an eighth grade education or less. And then we moved from that to like everybody going to high school. We want everybody to graduate from high school. Then we move from that to they not only need to graduate from high school, but they need to get this deeper, more conceptual underlying knowledge, and that their education should mean or be more purposeful to them. So like we keep significantly raising the ambitions. And so we have to keep changing the sort of underlying structures. And so if I would be hopeful, the reasons I would be hopeful is that the demand from the external environment is so aligned with what I'm saying. So people need these kind of skills to function in the world. And so the fact that schools on the whole, with the exception of some particularly strong teachers, don't supply them, that creates a really significant pressure for change. And then also outside of school, the kinds of learning experiences that are emerging are just proliferating at a huge rate. You can learn pretty much anything about anything you want to know, like basically instantly from your device. And if you don't want to learn from your device, you can go to like a
meetup or a group or a rec center. There are like so many opportunities for people to learn out there in the world. And so eventually the fact that those out-of-school learning opportunities are so plentiful and powerful, and that the ways that schools are organized, not the people inside schools, who I think would do more great things if given a chance, is so not reflective of those needs, at some point, like, something's got to give. So I think that that demand will gradually lead to change. And that is sort of, because we have a big decentralized system, that's the way it changes. That, like, basically that people in different communities come to desire different things over time. And so as those things change, what the schools do change. So like, for better or worse, our schools are pretty permeable institutions. So like, if you go into schools today, especially in affluent settings, you'll see like classes in yoga. Now, is that good or bad? I don't know. It depends on your goals and values. But it's interesting, right? It sort of suggests that this is popular in the culture now, and thus it's like now made it into schools, into lots of schools. And so gay rights, like when I was in school, there was not one out student at my fairly progressive school. And now at my school, 20 years later, you know, there are gay couples coming to prom and so on and so forth. So like, as society changes, schools will change also to reflect it. And so I think the ways that learning opportunities are developing are becoming much more interesting and sophisticated. And so you have to hope that eventually we will open up the barriers and let some of that into schools.
Jal Mehta is associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.